And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, July 12th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Akhil Sharma and Scott Spencer. First up is Akhil Sharma. His first published novel, An Obedient Father, won the 2001 Hemingway Foundation Pen Award. His second, Family Life, won the 2015 Folio Prize and the 2016 International Dublin Literary Award. He was on the show for both of those books, and his third is a collection of short stories, A Life of Adventure and Delight, which will be our primary focus this morning. Welcome back, Akhil.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Let's talk a bit about putting together this book of short fiction. I am curious if these are stories you wrote over time with the idea of someday putting a collection together.
I wrote them over time, over 25 years, but I didn't write them thinking of them as a collection. What I found very strange when I was when I did begin thinking about assembling a collection was how concerned they are about the same themes, you know, this sort of over and over.
Uh-huh.
Found that very interesting. I also found it interesting organizing the collection, how different the styles are, like from when I was, the earliest story that I wrote was when I was 19, which was If You Sing Like That to Me. And the most recent one is You're Happy? ?
Mm-hmm.
And they're so different in style that it was interesting to organize them, because they feel in many ways almost like different writers.
Mm.
And you do wonder, or at least I wondered as I was doing it, whether there was too much of a shock moving between voices.
Well, I was curious. I was going to talk to you about that, about how did you arrange the stories? I mean, what sort of things did you have to keep in mind as you were doing that?
The first thing is, of course, to hold the reader's attention or grab the reader's attention. And so, you know, I began with I think the most crowd pleasing story, which is Cosmopolitan.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's so funny. I think of it as so funny. And then I wanted to show range, you know, and so then I switched to Surrounded by Sleep. And so it was sort of thinking, like, how is a reader going to respond to these stories? I knew to put If You Sing Like That for Me, which is very sort of emotional and in some ways deals with love in a sort of very serious way, you know, with tenderness, before I put in A Life of Adventure and Delight, which feels much more damaged, because I didn't feel like if you sing like that followed, it would get the same response from the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And so these sort of things I did. But what's strange is I don't know if most readers read collections from beginning to end. I mean, I know that mostly what I do is I read the first story, the last story, and the title story. That's how I tend to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually that's where, you know, those tend to be the showstoppers.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, I tend to skip around. I'll read the first one, and then mm-hmm. I just sort of flip through and find the next one, and then the next
mm-hmm.
one. And I think I read the last one, the well next to the last. I think I went to that, and then I went back up to maybe the one following Surrounded by Sleep. I don't know why. I think perhaps, you know, I would read the first sentence or the the title or something. I don't, you know, it's interesting. The next time I deal with a book of short stories, I'm going to pay more attention to what exactly is influencing the order mm-hmm. in which I read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. But, you know, I think of you more, I mean, now I also think of you as a short story writer, but before this book, I have thought of you as a writer who really focuses on the long form. And so I'm curious about the stories, if you wrote them as palate cleansers between longer projects, or you have an idea and you know it's there's not enough traction to write a novel around it, and so it becomes a short story, or exactly, you know, if you could sort of walk us through what happens and how you start focusing on the stories, and then, you know, how you finish, how you decide to finish.
I know how to write a short story much more than I know how to write a novel. Just because I sort of know, okay, it's 15 pages. You know, that's probably what the length of it is going to be, 15 to 22 pages. I can sort of hold that in my head. I can hold what is the voice, what is the situation, what are the sort of scenes that are needed to create intensity. With the novel, it's so bizarre and complex. It's like building a city. And I don't know how to do that. I mean, I know how to wander into a situation that can grow into the city, but I don't know how to design it from the without wandering into it. I am, with both novels and short stories, I have this tremendous fear of the reader losing interest. Mm. And so the way I write is to, with that same sort of, with both of them, I seek a narrative which the reader can't turn away from. So in that sense, they seem similar to me. They were not palate cleansers, but they do feel like an emotional relief after writing a novel. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, with my last book, with Family Life, it took 12 and a half years to write it, which was just truly a nightmare, you know, I mean, just crazy. And I just, it was such a relief to write a story. The day I sent in the manuscript, I began writing, we didn't like him. And I just thought, you know, this worse comes to worse, I can throw it away. You know, versus you can't do that with a novel. Once you want, spent a lot of time in the book, you have to make it work. Mm-hmm. It's like a relationship, you know, a marriage. Once you've had kids, it's much, much harder to separate.
So true. So true. Well, you know, speaking of which, Surrounded by Sleep, I recognized the material from your novel Family Life, and I found mm-hmm. it interesting that here is a short story sort of dealing with the same or similar material. And so, mm-hmm. And I know as writers, we have stories we tell over and over again from different points of view or different, you know, different places, focusing on different places. And so I'm curious about that. If you just had, after Family Life, if you just had more material or you just had something more you had to do with it?
Well, I wrote Surrounded by Sleep long before I wrote Family Life.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote it, and I wrote it very quickly. It took two or three days, maybe 4 or 5 days, but not longer than that. It was an intensely pleasurable experience. And after I did that, there was a real sense that a lot of this stuff, a lot of things had not been said. And so it made sense to try to create a novel using the same situation. So the short story came first. And it's different, you know, it's third person.
Mm-hmm.
The thrust of it is very different. The thrust of it is, you know, just how one, the aloneness of this character. Whereas the thrust of Family Life is this coming of age.
Yeah. Well, in that story, you begin with the accident and you end with the accident, coming full circle. You do that in other stories too, sort of the ending meeting the beginning. And I was curious if that was a conscious act, if when you're writing, you're, and as you are getting to the end, if you're thinking or looking back to the beginning to see how to sort of come full circle. Or is that just happening? Are you just, it's just so intuitive. It just happens that way.
Well, the beginning is, you know, the beginning sets up what the story is going to be about. And the ending, the story then works out whatever the beginning is. And so to some extent, it's natural that at the ending we have an understanding of what exactly the beginning meant. So, for example, in Your Happy Question Mark, the character begins by wanting his mother beaten. But in the end, he feels enormous revulsion as to violence against women. And so that's the working out. I think it's just sort of, that's the nature of these sort of stories. So there's that they're rooms instead of, a story is a room versus a story versus a novel, which is, you know, you go down one road and then you go down another road. And by reading it, the reader is transformed. By reading it, the subject matter is so transformed that we come out in a place which we had not expected.
Interesting. This would be a great time to hear you read. Would you read from one of your stories?
Sure. This is from The Well.
Okay.
When I was a child, I was always falling in love. I fell in love with Mrs. Muir from The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, with Mary Jane, Spider-Man's girlfriend, with Wonder Woman. I loved the last two especially. I would imagine going for drives with Linda Carter or for walks in a park. I imagined us sitting on a sofa and holding hands. The fact that I could not drive and Wonder Woman would have to drive for us embarrassed me. It made obvious the difference in our ages. I felt that the proper relationship for me was with Mary Jane, who was younger and a cartoon, although I liked Linda Carter more. As the years passed, we moved from Queens to New Jersey. I was 13, and the town we moved to had a lot of construction going on. When a house was nearly done, it would stand with landscaping around it, where one could see through the front windows into the backyard. If, on my father's evening walks, he came to a house with a new lawn that had freshly laid rectangles of turf, he would hurry home, get into his car, and drive back to the house. He would crawl over the lawn, peeling sections of turf from the yard. He would carry these into the back of his car and bring them home to our own lawn, which was yellow and sunburned with rectangular patches of bright green. One summer evening, I was sitting at my desk in my room upstairs when I heard my father's car. In the back were the sheets of turf. My mother came running out of the house and stood by the driver's side door. "If you're going to steal, don't steal during the day," she screamed. "Do you know nothing?" "Grass doesn't belong to anyone," my father said, getting out of the car. "Grass is like air. Do people pay to put air on the lawn?" My mother was so angry, she was panting. I cranked open my window. I leaned out. "Are you circus folk?" I yelled.
Do you want to go on?
No.
Okay, that was great. That was Akhil Sharma reading from The Well, the last story in A Life of Adventure and Delight, published by Norton. A little more about endings. I noticed that many of your short stories are open-ended at the end in a very nice way. And so I am curious about that. I mean, you don't tie things up in such a way that it feels too neat, and yet the story has ended. And so I wonder if you could talk about endings, and then maybe you know, there are a couple of stories. We didn't like him, and a heart is such a heavy thing. If you could talk about the endings of those stories.
Sure. You know, when you, life is always going to go on, right? You know, these enormously important things occur, and then other important things will occur. So in Surrounded by Sleep, it begins with the accident, and it ends with the character thinking about the fact that the pool where this accident occurred, probably it wasn't rain, probably people continued to swim in it. And there has to be, I think, in a story, a recognition of that something important has occurred, and the fact that even though it's important, it doesn't matter that much, you know, in the large scale of life. I think that's just sort of a natural humility that life teaches you. We know, for example, in Your Happy Question Mark, that this enormously important thing has occurred. We know that the character has been transformed, or at least has been changed in some way, but we don't know what's going to happen with the rest of his life. There isn't a comfort at the end of these stories. There's a change, and there might be growth, but there isn't any comfort, really, from that growth. In terms of We Didn't Like Him, I write several false endings before I get to the real one. And in that one, I had him, had the two characters, the just talking and sitting in a car. And it didn't feel enough. It felt sort of like the energy had been let out, leaked out. And I was thinking about what are things that occur. And I remember that after my brother's accident, the first thing you do is you think about what actually happens in real life. And I remember that after my brother's death, when I was when I had to go to the Ganges to put his ashes in the river, I had to then bathe in it and throw away everything I had worn during the funeral ceremonies. And I remember, and I thought, you know, that there are similar things that occur, or certainly can occur, and one of them is that before you re-enter, I mean, there are all these rituals that you have to do before you re-enter your own home, and I can certainly imagine this sort of ritual occurring. That is, you before you come into the lane, you're purified by being bathed. And so using my own life, I was able to then imagine an alternate ritual which would work for these particular characters. So I take what I sort of know about life, and I try to find some emotional parallel that would be satisfying within the context of the story.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So how many drafts do your stories tend to go through, and do you have readers along the way?
I used to do many drafts of stories, but I think that that's probably a bad idea. Because I find that what occurs is that you spend vast amounts of time revising stories that are not good. So, for every six stories probably that I write, that I do complete drafts of, there's one that is publishable. And what I now do is I write a draft, I revise it a little bit, and then I show it to two people to get their opinion. And then I decide, if they tell me that this thing is alive, that it feels like there's life in it, then I'll revise it again and again and again to see if I can make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But I now, after having written Family Life and having spent 12 and a half years, I just don't want to commit myself to something which is not working, which is resisting me. Because there's so many worthwhile stories to write. Why waste one's time chasing stories that are difficult? So with some of these stories, there are only three or four drafts.
Is it the same with novels? Was it the same with your two novels?
No, I mean with the novels, it takes forever. I mean, for Family Life, I wrote 7,000 pages, and I would finish a draft, and I would begin with an empty document, mm-hmm. with a blank document, and start writing it again, just to keep myself disciplined about not cutting and pasting. And so there are chapters in Family Life that had that I have 30 or 40 drafts of. That's insane. That's crazy.
It may sound insane, but the book did very well, and you won awards for it, and I loved it. So it's insane to you, and of course to the reader, you know, how wonderful that it exists.
And you know, I am glad that the book came out and was successful. Usually, though, what occurs when you have books that are worked that heavily is that they become quite muddy. Mm. You know, it's like a chalkboard which people have written on and then erased and written on and then erased, but mm-hmm. nobody has washed thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that too much revision can actually ruin a story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've heard that said before. There are writers that, you know, say, you know, you've worked a lot on something, it's not working, put it away, go on. Mm-hmm. And yet mm-hmm. other writers, I mean, you wrote 7,000 pages and you came out with a nice, tidy, wonderful book. So mm-hmm. I don't know. What's the answer? I don't know. What about your relationship with social media? Because I didn't find a website for you. And of course, you've won numerous awards. So for you, it may not even be necessary for you to have any sort of presence on social media. But I wonder if your publicists at the publishers lean on you to be more active.
You know, with Family Life, they asked me to set up a website. They asked if I wanted to do a book trailer. And I find that for me, I can get too obsessive about these sort of things. You know, my vanity gets kicked up. I wish to be loved. And so I can get quite engaged with these, with seeing what's happening with the book. And so I choose, because I think that would be damaging for me, I choose not to be at all involved in this sort of stuff. I try my best not to read reviews. So with Family Life, I read only two reviews. One by accident, simply because I happened to have the newspaper and I opened it and there was a review, and then it was irresistible. But I don't Google myself. I don't read reviews. I'm a big believer in, you know, just be moving forward onto the next thing, mm-hmm. and let the book find its own life.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. We have a couple of minutes left, and before I ask you for a little bit of advice for the writers listening, I wanted to say two things. And one is that some time ago, I think when Family Life was coming out, there was a piece by you, I believe, in the New York Times where you talked about being in a park and praying for random people passing
mm-hmm,
by.
Mm-hmm.
Am I remembering that accurately?
And
I've wanted to tell you that since I read that piece, I will occasionally do that. I'll be somewhere and I'll think of that piece and I will, you know, say a random prayer for people passing by. It's really kind of interesting how that piece stayed with me.
You know, in fact, right before the interview, I was just doing that. I was doing my morning prayers. And so that's part of my ritual.
Interesting. Yeah, I love that. I love that. I thought that was great. And the other thing is, I love your acknowledgments page. And I don't want to give it away now. But all of you out there, when you pick up this book, do read the acknowledgments in the back. I just love it. It's in the same voice as your stories, and it's really interesting. It's quite honest. I love that about the publisher, and that was great.
So, yeah, you know, it's better to just be truthful.
Yeah, well, that comes through in your work. You know, it's refreshing. So in closing, I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
I think the only thing I would do, you know, I'm 46 in a week, and the only thing that I would do differently between, you know, if I could do it all over again is I would just try to worry less, you know. That's mm-hmm. the only thing I would do differently, and that's what I would advise writers.
Yeah.
You know, just try to don't worry as much, you know, do your work, and it might work out, it might not work out, you know, but worrying isn't going to help you that much.
Right.
Often. So that's the only truly useful advice I can give.
I love it. And I am so glad to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
That was Akhil Sharma. His new book is A Life of Adventure and Delight, published by Norton. And it's a wonderful collection of short stories. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Scott Spencer. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We continue to broadcast from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org. And you can also subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. If you do that, whenever we upload a new podcast, which is generally within a week after the show airs, you'll receive a little notification in your inbox somewhere, your iTunes inbox, your music inbox, somewhere. Trust me, it'll be there. And if you do that, you'll also help others to find it more readily. I should also say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of my guest and me. So we are back with Scott Spencer. Scott has written 11 novels. Two of his novels, Endless Love and Waking the Dead, have been adapted into films. He's been on the show before, and he's back to talk about his recent novel, River Under the Road. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Barbara. How you doing?
Great. Great to have you on. And
great to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you on and to talk about this book. I really loved it, and as I do all of your work. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about how it came about.
Well, I really don't know exactly how it came about because it took me several years to write it. So the initial ignition becomes a little dim. I mean, it's about this town that I call Leyden, New York, and I've set several of my books there, so I continually revisit the area and the people who I imagine to be living there, and it's not totally unlike where I do live in so-called real life, which is in Dutchess County in upstate New York. And I was very interested in finding a way to explore some of the class divide and the cultural divide that you see more and more prevalently in this area. And I started imagining first one character, then another character, then tried to just figure out a way that I could bring them together. And then I was going to say I was off to the races, but, you know, a book that takes 6 years to write, you're obviously not off to the races. You're off to the stumbling around and slapping yourself on the forehead, because I don't even dare go back to my computer and figure out how many drafts this went through before I felt it was ready to send to the publisher. But I'm actually sort of used to that frustration because I've always worked that way. I find out more and more about what my concerns are and what the reality of my characters are by writing. I think, you know, in the end, I might be better at writing than I am at thinking, because that's really how I'm sort of condemned to write book after book, which is, you know, the book might come in at 325 pages or 350 pages, I'm not really sure. But in order to get those 350 pages, I probably wrote something like 2,000 pages.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, why a fictional town? Why Leyden? What can you do with that that you might not be able to do if you set it in a town that actually exists?
Well, I didn't want to do a town that actually exists, because I just wanted to give myself freedom to imagine things that were maybe more dramatic than things that I could actually find in the historical record of an actual town. It gives me freedom, and it forces me to imagine my way into the lives of these characters. I mean, there's certain places in the novel that are, you know, geographically, realistically, like there's scenes in New York and there's scenes in Chicago. But for the main locus of the piece, I wanted it to be a slightly fictional version of where I live, because it gives me latitude. And the reason I wanted to put it in that place is that in certain small communities, it's difficult for people not to have their lives intersect, whereas lives in cities are more and more ghettoized, not only by race but by class, and people can go through weeks and months, maybe years of their life, and not really have their own experience mix with the people who are very different from them.
Interesting. And the 70s and 80s, why did you set the book there?
Well, my impulse in writing this book was to cover a wide swath of time. And in point of fact, I'm continuing this book and hope, you know, by the time I'm done, to bring it up to the present time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very I think that one of the advantages you have when you get older as a novelist is that you have a new appreciation for how lives unfold and how the consequence of acts that are committed when you're 25 come back and shape your life when you're 55. And I wanted to give an expression of this sort of new knowledge that I have. And I wanted to do something I really wasn't able to do in my previous novels, which is to spend time with my characters as they make their way through history. And in fact, Barbara, the history was a really important consideration when I was writing this book. And even the title is my sort of note to myself, which is River Under the Road is history. It's all the time and events and crises that pass below us as we go through our daily lives and shape us in ways that we're only vaguely aware of.
Interesting. Well, I would love to hear you read a little bit from River Under the Road.
Oh, I would love to do that. Well, the easiest thing to do would be to read from the very beginning.
Okay.
But that's just what I'm not going to do. Because and I just came upon this morning, and I wrote it a year and a half ago, so it seemed a little fresh to me.
Okay.
And this is a scene that, with the main male character's name is Thaddeus, who is now unexpectedly affluent, and he is attending a benefit for a blind child from a working-class family that's held at a evangelical church. And he's walking with his own family, his wife and his children, through the parking lot of the church and the youth center of the church, which is called the Christian Fun Zone. And he's on his way to attending this benefit. Thaddeus listened to the voracious crunch of the gravel as he and his family made their way from the car to the Christian Fun Zone. He recalled the many times he'd passed by this spot during construction, the 100-pound sacks of cement stacked in a semicircle like sandbags in a battle zone. The backhoe, the size of a rhinoceros, the razz of transistor radios, the whine of saws, the ringing of hammers, the smell of tar, the shirtless young men, the portly older guys crouched over their saw horses, showing deep ass cleavage, extreme tans, boards, nails, screws, bolts, glass, copper, wire, copper pipes, polyurethane, putty, plumbing, paint, and pay by the hour. Wherever his eye landed was evidence that the world was made by others, and he enjoyed it like a child enjoys a stuffed toy dropped into his crib. Out there, somewhere, in the brutal beyond were the road crews and the logging crews, the masons and truckers, steel workers, chemical workers, orderlies and electricians, paper hangers, bakers, the men in blood-spattered smocks, eviscerating cattle, soldiers in tanks breathing their own stink, soldiers leaping from planes, soldiers ditching helicopters in sandstorms, soldiers bleeding, dying. Who made this world? Who made the clothes on his back, the shoes on his feet, the fillings in his teeth?
Love it. Thank you. That was Scott Spencer reading from River Under the Road, published by Echo. An aside, on page 104, I think it is, your characters throw a party on the last day of June. And I read that page on the last day of June. I'm like,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's so strange.
It was really strange. you've been on before. You were on for an hour, and there are questions I want to ask you that I asked you then, but instead I'm going to just direct listeners to search out that podcast to listen to that. So I'm not going to ask you certain things again about side characters and such, but what I do want to say is that, and we talked about this last time, is you are just so good at telling details and showing actions or observations about characters, such a strength. And for instance, because I want to ask you sort of how you come up with such specific observations. On 121, I'm going to read this graph or part of a graph. She looked at her watch, and then her gaze locked onto Thaddeus. Sometimes when his mother looked at him, it felt like the captain from an enemy vessel had just boarded his ship to dictate the terms of surrender. I love that. And there's like millions of these sort of observations. Can you reconstruct coming up with details like that? Or is this an easy, is this the easy part for you?
It's not easy. I never want to use the word easy when we're talking about writing. Because it's all so hard, and I'm patient, and I'm willing to do things over and over until something comes alive. I think that it's really just closing your eyes and imagining your way into a scene. Now, the exact phrases, sometimes it's just a gift, and it just rolls off, and it's, you know, you want to be bright, and you want the sentence to have some snack and some snap and some life to it, and you'll come up with something that's pleasing, like that captain that you just read. But often that telling detail, which seems like I just let it roll off my tongue or from the tips of my fingers, is doesn't see the light of day until the third draft.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I've been freed from the work of setting the scene up, of describing where they are, of knowing what's at stake, and my mind can apply itself to different things, to finding some amusing or fresh way of putting it.
So do you have then different ways or different things you're doing as you go through draft after draft? I mean, are you, you know, forgetting about word choice until you get down, you know, you have a draft pretty solid, or are you tweaking all of it every time you go back in?
I'm tweaking all of it every time.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't have like a character draft and then a language draft.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same to me. It's all the same. I think probably you've heard other writers quote this E.L. Doctorow line, mm-hmm, about that writing a novel is like driving your car at night and you can just see as far as the headlights reach into the darkness, which I think is a really smart and basically true thing to say about writing. But I would add one thing to it, that the more intense the writing is, the language is, the brighter those headlights shine, and you can see even more. So I never relax and just say, oh, I'm just going to slap this down and just get the general idea, or just find who these characters are, or what the outline of the action would be. Every time I write, I try to write with as much intensity and clarity and carefulness as I can.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. So Jennings and Grace, you do something with Jennings and Grace I found really interesting, and that is that they are carrying on in secret, and you pretty much keep what's happening a secret from the reader as well until close to the end. And I don't know if you intended that or it just happened that way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I intended it.
Of course you did.
And there are clues that that's happening all along.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew all along. So, you know, in that way, my knowledge of what is transpiring colors those scenes and very much colors Grace's reactions and the way she's raising her daughter. So, yes, that wasn't just an aha moment in the last chapter. That was very intended, and it's sort of the springboard into the next book.
Oh, okay. Well, did you know how Thaddeus would react or would not react before you got there?
Not entirely. I mean, by the time I was writing the last draft, of course, I did, because at that point things were settling down in terms of the psychology and the plot of the book. But I thought that Thaddeus could react in a couple of, maybe even three different ways. And I sat with all of them for quite a long time, because obviously it's very important. But it's hard to talk about this without kind of spoiling some of the fun of the book. But I chose the path that he finally takes, because I thought it was truest to him, and it went with his character as it was from the very beginning of the book.
Hmm.
And you know, frankly, he adores her too much to take any other path.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, he's a great character, as is she. And I was curious, too, because it's a multiple point of view novel, and you rove from one character to another so seamlessly, even in the same chapter. I think on 170, you go from Muriel to Buddy Klein to Thaddeus, and as a reader, you hardly notice that it's happening. And I wonder if you could say a few words about that, about multiple point of view novels and how you orchestrate them.
Well, that close third person point of view, which gives you a way to kind of have that old-fashioned narration without surrendering the psychology that we have, you know, come to depend upon in the more modern novel, is really a great tool. It's for a writer a source of great freedom, I think, that once you establish that rhythm, that you can go in and out of characters, the reader becomes very accustomed to it, and it gives you as a writer, first of all, the responsibility to understand all of your characters and to know that any one of them could, in fact, be narrating this scene. And it also gives you a chance to pick out what's psychologically most interesting at any given moment. Now, obviously, I mean, for writers who are listening to this, you know that you can't just hop willy-nilly from one person's thoughts to another. There has to be a kind of coherence to it. There has to be a kind of purpose to it. It has to be giving you information that is necessary and interesting, and that furthers your investment in the overall story. But I love doing that. I think probably the majority of my books have been written in the first person, and which is also a lot of fun, because it's sort of a more musical approach to it, because it's so dependent on that one voice carrying you through. But there's a kind of largeness of spirit that you pick up when you're responsible for the inner lives of several characters that I found really fascinating and instructive.
Mm. Yeah, that's funny. I was going to follow up with asking if you prefer writing multiple point of view novels, and it sounds like you do.
I like them both, and really for the next step in this journey that I'm on with these characters, it's being written just from the point of view of one of the characters.
Oh, okay. Well, now I can't wait to read that one, and I hope I don't have to wait for years and years.
You always say the nicest things, Barbara. I'm never leaving this interview.
Well, it's true. It's all true. And we only have a few minutes left, which is totally depressing. You'll have to come to California and come to one of my speaker series so we can...
I would love to, but I have a kid living in Los Angeles, so I have a double impetus to do it.
Okay. Well, I'm after the show later on, I'm going to email you and we're going to talk more. But I wonder if in just getting, you know, we have a few minutes left, if you could talk a little bit about what you do when you're writing something that just isn't working. Like, how do you write yourself out of that? Or, you know, how do you get yourself going? Or do you always know what you're going to write the next day? You know, if you could talk a little bit just about process. I can't do that.
Okay. I mean, when I was just starting off as a writer, I took very seriously Hemingway's advice, which is you stop writing before you're completely empty, so you have a place to pick up from the next day, which I think is great advice. You know, because getting started is hard. It's hard. And once you get going, it's just like, you know, someone giving the car a little push. Sometimes the engine will catch and you can have a nice ride. But sometimes, and, you know, frankly, often, the problem is more serious than that, and it's not just a question of getting started, but you're genuinely stuck. And I have found in basically 100% of the cases that the problem really isn't on the page that you're working on, that it's several pages before then. When something has happened, when the boat has sprung a leak and it's taking on water and it's sinking, you've made some choice. Because, of course, when you're writing, you're constantly making choices, and the choices that you make on page 7 totally influence what happens on page 8, and then page 9, and page 10. And so page 10, you're stuck. The problem is probably on page 6 or 7, where you've made a choice that has drained some of the energy and some of the momentum and some of the meaning out of what you're working on. So the problem is then to find out where that wrong turn was made and go back, think about that, address that, and I have found that the work will pick up after that.
Interesting. Now, do you find this on your own, or do you have readers that that you show your work to that help you figure it out?
I have a couple of readers, more than a couple, maybe 3, 4, 5, whose opinion I really value and depend upon, but I don't depend on them to help me find those kind of fixes. Mm-hmm. That is unfortunately done in complete solitude. And when it's as good as I can make it, when I feel like I've just done everything I can humanly do, then I will ask someone else to take a look at it to see if, you know, if it works for them.
Hmm. Well, once again, it's been just a tremendous pleasure to have you on, and the next book as well. I'll be bugging you to come back, and we'll talk more about when you're coming to L.A.
Barbara, I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you and your listeners. It's really been fun to have this conversation.
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
That was Scott Spencer. His new novel is River Under the Road, published by Echo. And, yeah, it's a favorite. Loved it. You know how when you're reading and you keep looking at page numbers to see how far you are, and how much longer. I didn't do that with this. It's like, oh no, there's not much left. I love books like that where you just forget about page numbers and you just look forward to getting into the story. That's The River Under the Road is one of those for me. In any case, Marie will be here next week. Thank you for being with me. And writers out there, remember to stay in the chair.